From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the former Utah Poet Laureate, Catherine Coles, joining us to tell a story about her grandmother. A character, a pistol, gifted and funny and adventurous, plays the role of a happy wife and mother, but wasn't really satisfied with her life and relationships. About 20 years ago now, Coles started going through her letters and her diaries and her documents, none of which told the real story of this remarkable and complicated woman. Join us in just a moment.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West. So thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let me introduce you to some of the characters in Catherine Coles' new book. There's Mandy. Let's say she's the matriarch of the family, charming in public, but cruel to those close to her, including her children. There's Miriam, Mandy's daughter. This is Cole's grandmother, who was trained as a geologist and longed for this life of adventure. There's Walter, Miriam's husband, Cole's grandfather, also trained as a geologist, also an adventurer. There are others, but then there's Coles herself. This is not a novel. It's more a memoir, though it's not exactly that. Coles, by the way, is a poet, the former poet laureate for Utah. She's written a number of poetry collections. She's written novels. She already has a memoir. But this book is different. And it all started about 20 years ago when she got hold of her grandmother Miriam's journals. Walter worked for Standard Oil, so he took Miriam and their children to exotic places. They met exotic people. Miriam was known to be restless, and there were rumors. So you'd think the journals would be scandalous and juicy. But not exactly. Or at least, it took some careful reading by Catherine to find the real story in those journals, but also in letters and papers, photos too. Today in the program, Catherine Coles is joining us to talk about the story that she pieced together of her grandparents' lives and how she became part of it. The book is called Look Both Ways. One of the things Coles says she uncovered about her grandmother was just how truly unfulfilled she felt about her life. But that wasn't the woman she knew when she was young.
My grandmother and I had an affinity for each other. She, I think, saw in me a potential for fulfillment. She saw in me a potential for a relationship that she did not have with her own daughter, my mother. So there was that on the one hand, the intimacy of our relationship. And as I became old enough to visit her on my own without my parents, I began to hear stories from her that cracked open this door for her as being a more exotic creature than I might have thought. But within the family realm, what I witnessed was another thing that comes out in the book, which was her frustration and her rage. And this was not an emotion that I was unaccustomed to living with, because my mother was also frustrated with what it was to be a very gifted woman in the world. And eventually I would discover that my great-grandmother also experienced these kinds of frustrations. But those frustrations emerge within the domestic sphere in bursts of anger, et cetera. And so I learned to watch out for my grandmother's rage within the family, as I had learned to watch out for my mother's anger. I will say that I think that it improved from generation to generation. The most ticked off woman was my great-grandmother.
and Mandy.
Yeah. And another thing that sort of happens, I think, is this impulse for each generation, as things get better for women, to live a little bit through the next generation.
Yeah.
And that becomes a projection of hope, but also within that is a kind of resentment. And I think one of the things that happened with my grandmother and me was it was possible for that resentment to skip a generation.
Did your mother resent her mother relating to you in a way that she hadn't your mother?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a question you would finally have to ask my mother. And yeah. One of the things I'm trying to very hard not to do is tell her story, because it really is very much her story.
Yeah.
But I will say from my own point of view that as I became more aware of the dynamics and what was causing them. And my grandmother was truly a terrible mother. I mean, there's just no question about that. She was a bad mother. Her mother was a bad mother. And this is, poor parenting is something that is often, you know, transferred from generation to generation. My mother was a much better mother than either of them were. But I felt as I became an adult and really developed this relationship with my grandmother and saw her as this romantic and dashing figure, I was also aware increasingly what a terrible mother she had been, partly because she lived this romantic and dashing life. And I think I understood in a way that my affinity for my grandmother was a kind of betrayal of my mother.
Hmm. Let me step back a minute and talk about when you actually get this trove of documents. Mm-hmm. Did they all come at once?
They kind of did. So I had obviously my own letters from my grandmother, which I had saved.
Yeah.
And as I visited her alone, I started asking her to go through her photographs with me. And I would have her label the backs of the photographs, who the people were. And I started asking her to tell me stories. And there was much that she would not say at that point. And then my mother and her brothers went to Florida to try to shovel out the house, get my grandmother ready to move should that have to happen. And my mother called me from Florida and she said, well, I have these hand-painted tea sets and I know they're not really your style, but I'm packing them up. I'm going to send them to you just in case. And I said, you know what I really want is the letters, the journals, the photographs, all of the documents. And there was this long pause on the other side of the phone. And my mother finally said, I think we've already thrown all that away. And then there was a long pause on my side.
I detected that long pause in the way you write about this, by the way.
Oh,
and my heart kind of sang.
Yeah, good. I'm very glad. So there was this pause. And then I said, well, whatever is there, don't throw any more away. Just put it in a box. You don't have to sort it. Just send it to me. And she said, well, if it's okay with Grandmama, then what was related to me later was that there had been a long pause when my mother said, this is what Katie wants. And my grandmother said, well, you do know I fell in love a few times, don't you? And this is sort of when the door cracks a little bit wider open and I think, oh, there's going to be some stuff here that nobody knows about. So my mother packed up the documents and she sent them not to me but to herself. And then she sat on him for a while. Wow. And there was actually – and that was okay because I wasn't ready yet to start writing. And I certainly wasn't going to start until my grandmother had passed away. And then shortly after then, I started to work to extract the letters from my mother.
It's so interesting the way your grandmother mentions a diary. It, almost like it's only for her. And that you shouldn't share it with the family because they'll be disillusioned. So I wondered, she was writing this to talk to herself, I guess, because I didn't get a sense anyway that she intended for you or anyone else in the family to see these stories and these revelations.
I think these things are very complicated. And, you know, I'm sure it's because I'm a writer that I feel this way. But I actually don't think anyone ever writes a diary that they don't somehow fantasize somebody will see.
I agree.
That they don't somehow fantasize.
So what did she mean by that?
Yeah, I think we have a double consciousness,
yeah,
right, about these things. So I actually read that moment where she says people might be disillusioned if they see it as being a moment of awareness that people are going to see it. And in fact, there is a moment in her marriage with my grandfather when she begins to suspect that he's reading her diaries. And she actually begins to use the diaries, in my opinion, A, to communicate with him, but also to lie to him. And so there's a lot that the diaries imply that they don't come out right and say.
Yeah.
That if she really thought that nobody was reading them or would ever read them, she would have said.
Which makes it all the more interesting for you to see these diaries with all these intentions written at different times in her life and have to now decipher or create some kind of real narrative out of them. Because how much of that is real? You don't really know, I guess, when you first see them.
You don't really know when you first see them. And in fact, because I was seduced by the family lore, and can we take, for example, the story of Bert Butler?
For sure.
Bert Butler was the Canadian Trade Commissioner in what was then Batavia, Indonesia, entered my grandmother and grandfather's social circle.
Your grandfather's sort of best friend, at least.
So he was my grandfather's best friend, yeah. Was sort of took charge of looking after Miriam when Walter was off in the field macheting his way through the jungle for months at a time with leeches clinging to his body. Yeah. And Bert was there sort of looking after the then pregnant Miriam. And the family lore was that then Mandy came over, my great-grandmother visited, identified Bert as the right husband for her other daughter, Toni, in Milwaukee. And so Miriam sent him off to Milwaukee. He fell madly in love with Toni. They got married, and nobody lived happily ever after.
Right. That's the story.
That's the story.
Yeah.
So that's the family lore. But there was huge tension, even I was aware as a child, and they lived in Canada, but I knew that there was a huge problem in at the heart of that marriage as well. And it turns out that Bert and Miriam fell madly in love with each other. And that Miriam sending Bert off to Milwaukee to marry her sister was in part a sort of ploy to keep him close to her,
yeah.
To keep him in the family, and also to import her sister to Indonesia as a kind of companion. And that she somehow thought that that was going to go well is very astonishing. But as I'm reading along in the journals, there are hints at this, but I'm not seeing that because what I'm skating along is the story. I think I know the story.
Yeah, the family lore that they fell madly in love.
Right. And then there was this moment, and it was actually a note that she had written in the margin, and suddenly the scales came off my eyes, right?
Wow.
Suddenly I thought, oh, holy cow. And I went back to Bert's entry onto the scene. And after I had seen that, I was able to understand what was going on. And if I think about my grandfather, who probably did start reading the journals at this time because he became himself very suspicious.
Yep.
When I think about him also having no suspicions and then having suspicions and what becomes legible in the journal once you think you really do know this subtext or this other story that's going on is really interesting, I think, and part of the process of reading. So for all of those of you who are out there with your grandmother's journals and letters, remember, they lie.
Yeah. Read them carefully.
Read them carefully, yeah.
You're a poet. You've written novels. You've written essays. As you started to decipher what was going on in these documents, what did you want to do with them?
It was a moving target. And huh. I think at the beginning, I thought that I would probably write poems, that I would remedy my grandmother's poetic practice.
Fix her poems.
Fix her poems. Yeah. Write the poems that, you know, she may have written if she had come along a little bit later, but also intrude myself into them. And then when I got into the documents, and there were thousands of pages of letters and journals. I mean, thousands of pages. And when I got into them, I thought, oh, maybe this should be prose. And I thought about writing a novel. And then I thought then that the actual story was maybe interesting enough that it shouldn't be fictionalized in quite that way. And then I started...
Because there's a lot of good stuff.
There's a lot of good stuff in that. And then I started to travel. And so suddenly there was this sort of running narrative of my own that was going alongside their narrative, and I wasn't really sure what to do with that. And so then the idea or the question came to me, if I'm the parasite on the body of their work, maybe what I should do is let them be writers and let their words come into print alongside my words.
It's in that sense, the way you italicize their words in the book reminds me of poetry, stanzas. Like the way it seems like this discipline that you have as a poet comes forward in that. Is that wrong?
No, I think it is. I work by ear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think
totally. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes.
And I think all poets do probably work by ear. And I had to, first of all, gather the material and then carve out what was going to be a reasonably sized book. And I think that the skill as a poet is what finally had to come to bear. There is stuff that just got cut out that got left out, but there's a lot of stuff that just got condensed and that moved from the realm of the explicit to the implicit.
Yep, yep.
And that's what poetry does,
totally.
Right? Is it makes so many things implicit that in prose would be explicit. But it takes a long time.
Yeah. No, I imagine. But that's why I think the prose in the book, it seems unique and original in that sense because it's also poetry.
I hope so. Thank you.
Yeah. Part of me kept thinking, Kate just wants an excuse to travel, right? I mean, because she has this wanderlust, but it seems like that was, and I only meant that sort of jokingly, but the fact that you physically had to go to these places that Walter and Miriam went, that seemed really important to you. Why?
Well, first of all, I'd say that it's not only that I wanted an excuse to travel, but I was happy to have
travel. Really good.
So I'll cop to
You'll
that.
Cop to
absolutely.
That. Okay, good. But
I also think that there is, a palpability to a place that you cannot get through words on the page, that you cannot get through photographs or online. It's like the difference between... This is a weird analogy maybe, but between looking at a painting online and actually being able to get close enough so that you can see the texture of the paint on the canvas. So that's part of it, is the physicality of presence. Another piece of it that I hadn't necessarily expected is the presence of history and the ability to really experience the way in which time turns one place into another place, but still leaves the vestiges of the original place. So in this section, when I'm walking through what was then Batavia, which is now Jakarta, where the street names have changed, some of the buildings are still there, some of the buildings are gone, feeling as if I'm partly in their world, but also very much present in the modern world, became for me an important part of the experience of trying to go back in time and figure out how the past becomes the present, which is part of what this book is about.
What do you say? You say that it wasn't, her story isn't just romance, it's history.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And both of those things, I hope. I will say, by the way, that there was an editor that I was working with for a while on the book, and we parted ways for reasons that I think I'm about to make obvious. There was a moment, he was a gentleman about 20 years younger than I am who had really pushed me, and I'm grateful to him for this, to push that question of gender forward. And then he wrote to me at one point, really late in the process, and he said, what I still don't understand is why, knowing that how much your husband misses you, you still leave him and go off on these long journeys and spend all this money to do it. And I saw this email and I felt, I think what women often feel in these situations, I felt a kind of shame. And didn't actually show it even to my close friends for a while. And then I showed it to Melanie Tone, who's a wonderful female novelist. And she was shocked on my behalf, so allowed me to be a little shocked. And then I thought, a couple of weeks after that, I'm going to show this to my male writer friends because I really want to know if they think that an editor would ever, ever say that to a male writer. And they were more shocked than Melanie was. They absolutely were gobsmacked at the kind of assumption that I was undertaking a project or a journey that you would never think that John McPhee or Barry Lopez or any of those guys shouldn't go.
Well, and I think in that sense, one of the things you've talked about is that after the election of Donald Trump, 2016, and just that time, and I'm guessing sort of the Me Too movement as it takes hold as well. So you say something clicked with the politics of the moment. So in that sense, that is a filter through which to see some of these stories, certainly of Miriam and even your mom.
I think that's right. And in fact, that email came in the late spring of 2016, so as the election was really ramping up, and I put things aside for a little while. And then I actually went back after the election. I did one final rewrite, and it was that email, it was the election that enabled me to figure out what of my story I actually did want to tell and how I wanted to make this about gender. And another thing that this editor said to me is that he kept saying, I want you to tell your story about gender. And then later he said, well, I'm not sure that the press wants to tell the same story about gender that you want to tell. And this was another sort of moment of really? A man who's 20 years younger than I am is trying to tell me what the story about gender really ought to be. And so these kinds of things that I kept coming up against, finished the book really pretty quickly after the election, sent it out, and immediately four presses wanted to publish it pretty much as it was. All of those editors were female.
Catherine Coles is a poet and writer. She's a distinguished professor of English at the University of Utah, also poet in residence at the Natural History Museum of Utah and at the Salt Lake City Public Library. Her new book is Look Both Ways, A Double Journey Along My Grandmother's Far-Flung Path. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER wherever you go with our mobile app. Listen to a live stream of the station, get the latest stories from NPR and the KUER newsroom, or explore the newest Radio West podcast. You can even access our 24/7 streams of classical music and the BBC. It's not just any app. It's the KUER app, available for Android and iPhone wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the former Utah Poet Laureate Catherine Coles, joining us to tell a story about her grandmother. It's also a story about herself, actually. In her new book, it's called Look Both Ways, A Double Journey Along My Grandmother's Far-Flung Path. The way Miriam, your grandmother, is writing, a poem called Adventuring that she writes. Talk a little bit about what that revealed, because you say that Miriam imagined this vast world, but the thing that she couldn't imagine is herself.
Yeah, so that poem, it was kind of a revelation for me. And I was reading this poem of Mary's called Adventuring, and it begins in the first person. And it imagines this first person through the first two stanzas of the poem to plow the foaming waters of the boundless Spanish Main, et cetera, et cetera. And she ends the first stanza, all these would be fulfillment of my highest golden dream. And I'm with her. I'm adventuring with her. And then we get to the end of the second stanza to feel the rush and smother of a million airy bubbles. The dash and vigorous joy of life make. And she moves from the first person to the third person, and she changes gender.
Yeah.
The dash and vigorous joy of life make a fellow lose his troubles. And one of the things that I've always told my students is the moment where the poem sort of fails or something happens, look there. There's something important there. What I see in that moment is an expression of the problem that was going to be the problem of Miriam's life, which was the tension between her ambitions
and reality.
Yeah. And how she imagined herself and the body she had to imagine herself in.
So she allows herself in those first stanzas, this is me. And then as the poem evolves, the stanzas change to like, that can't be you,
Miriam.
Yeah?
That can't be you, right? And she could have, she actually had to disturb the rhythm of the poem to get that fellow in there.
Yeah.
She kind of sticks an extra beat in there. The rhythm fails a little bit. If she had said, makes me lose my troubles, it would have read better. So she had to make an effort in a way, but it was an obstacle she couldn't overcome, I think, in her mind, and she never did.
Early in the book, you go through this litany of these sort of should-haves for Miriam. You write that she never should have had children. She should have stayed home. She should never have married. She should have married somebody else. I mean, all of these possibilities for her life. She should have been everything she was and more, should have been ordinary. Talk to me a little bit about that litany, because what I think is interesting about it is you also, as you're thinking about this for yourself, you write, you wonder in the book if in her place, in her time, could you have been braver?
And I suspect the answer is no. And, you know, I will say that one of the things that I heard from my mother as I was growing up was this series of critiques, often very contradictory critiques, right, about my grandmother that, you know, she should have stayed home with her children. She shouldn't have had children. But the other piece of that, or the flip side of that, is that I also heard my mother say she should have been braver. She should have gone out if she wanted this explorer's life. She shouldn't have married it. She should have made it for herself against all these odds. She was weak. She was a coward, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, look, before you go on, embodied in all of those contradictory questions, it seems like the dilemma of a woman, right?
Yes.
Like, look, you shouldn't have had them. You should have gone out. You should have been braver. You should have stayed home. You should have stayed with your children.
Right.
Because those don't square.
No, they don't. They don't square. And so this question of how it is that a woman is supposed to navigate the world, how it is that she's supposed to find her fulfillment in the world. And I don't think we've solved this yet, by the way. I solved it for myself. I'm actually very content with the choices that I've made. I actually faced a fair amount of pushback from people whose business you might have said it was, and many people whose business it absolutely wasn't, about the fact that Chris and I didn't have children. And the person who got the pushback for that was not my husband. The person who got the pushback for that was me.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about something that Miriam, early on in her life, she her mother, Mandy, seems like a whole other book, but as you say, pretty cruel. I mean, yeah. publicly charming, but cruel to her, those close to her. But she did insist that Miriam get an education, yeah. Which was remarkable for the time. Mm-hmm. And at one point she writes, Miriam writes, if only I had enough character to know what I wanted. What's going on there at that point in her life, do you think?
I actually think that she is torn in a way that women still are. I certainly experienced this too. Your culture gives you a narrative about what your life is meant to be or is supposed to be. And you also have your own ambitions, your own interests. And I think she was really torn between those things. I think that she felt that she had to get married and that that would doom her to a certain kind of ordinary housewifely life. She really wanted to be out on her own having adventures, but that didn't, she couldn't see her way to that. And so she compromised, right, by marrying an explorer and imagining that this was going to be the way that she was going to be able to have her cake and eat it, too. And I actually think that he, well, I know that he encouraged her
Walter.
In thinking this. Walter. He too had a sort of romantic fantasy of the two of them being out in the jungle together, exploring, looking for oil. But he also at the same time had this much more hard-headed understanding of the way a man's world really works. So I think even while he was indulging his own and her fantasy that they would be geologists together in the wild, my guess is that he already had a much clearer understanding than she did of
the way things worked?
Yeah, the way things worked and the ways in which that just probably wasn't going to be possible. And
it's interesting you write that Miriam, she didn't this is how you put it in the book, she didn't think of Walter beside her, but about a distant land, a man returning to claim his beloved on a magic carpet. Which says what? That because you say she was distracted, she needed a companion because of the way things were. So Walter seemed as good as any.
And better than many. I mean,
right,
she was in college in the 1920s. She was surrounded by men, and she was special in a way.
Yeah.
She didn't have to be very special to have had her pick, right, of a number of men. And in fact, in some ways, the ways in which she was special excluded some men from,
yeah,
right, from the set of possibilities, some people who might have wanted somebody who was really much more conventional. But I'm convinced that she didn't love Walter the person so much as she loved, yeah, the idea of Walter or what he represented or the doors he might have opened, the opportunities he might have offered.
Do you think that that was true with him for her in some way too?
Oh, she certainly was. The Miriam he married was a creature of his own invention.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
If that's what you're asking, I think that's absolutely the case. And he idealized her, I think, very much in the way that many men idealized women.
Well, I was thinking about the photographs he took of her.
Yeah.
In the days before he went off to South America, mm-hmm, for 2 years or something, mm-hmm, like that. And you mentioned in the days before he left that he took all of these photographs, mm-hmm, of her. And I just wanted to ask you about them because you mentioned they became, this is how you put it, documents of an obsession that you can't explain. And you include them in the book.
So some of them.
Some of them.
Yeah.
Some of these images. Would you talk a little bit about this part? I wonder if they're a reflection of his idealized image of who she was.
I think they really are. And, you know, I will say about him, and I have to give him credit for this. So one of the things he loved about her was how outdoorsy she was, how capable she was in the water and in the land. She could climb anything. She was an amazing swimmer and diver. And one of the series of photographs is a series of shots of her diving. There are photographs of her fishing, casting a fishing line in front of a canoe, and she looks as if she's sort of pointing into the future.
They're pretty great.
They're pretty great shots, yeah. There's one of her standing on top of a cliff, and she kind of, in profile, and she, one of the things one wonders is, how did she get up there? Well, she got herself up there, right? And she looks like nothing so much as a Maxfield Parrish painting, I think, except in black and white, you know, without that saturated color. And so he's really... This series of photographs is her body in wild places. And this is where you really begin to see, I think, his imagination of her taking shape.
I wanted to ask you about the way you write about your own relationship with Chris.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you had intended to be so revealing, so candid about Chris's questions about why are you leaving again. I mean, and in some ways, these are not entirely mirror images, but they're very similar, to, it sounds like, to the kinds of questions Miriam and Walter went through.
Yeah, I think that's right. That editor wanted much more of my marriage to Chris to be present than actually is. And I had at one point put more of that in and then cut it back to in this final version to what it seemed to me really mattered about that, which is the way in which two people, and I think of Chris and me as sort of emblematic, right, in a sense, the way in which two people have because of their upbringing, because of their circumstances, simply different ways of thinking about their relationship with the world, with risk, with adventure, et cetera, and how they navigate that as a couple. And I actually hope that Chris comes off really well.
Of course,
in this,
he does.
Because he grew up in a very sort of not risk-taking Midwestern household. His mother was constantly pulling him back from the edges of cliffs where my parents were constantly pushing me toward
right.
the edges of cliffs. And so there is a sense in which there's not only maybe a biological, a genetic thing that happens there, but also a matter of training and a matter of your family teaching you how to position yourself vis-a-vis the world. And there also is the fact, and I hope it's okay if I say this, that my husband really adores me, which is great, right? It's the best possible thing. And so figuring out how to navigate that profound 30-year-long love that we have and at the same time navigate this difference in how you think that the world is there to be experienced. And also, partly because of that love, you know, he is afraid when I am traipsing off to Indonesia in 2002 when the State Department is telling us not to go there,
yeah.
right? And then later, finally, to Medellin, Colombia, and when I go off to Antarctica, right? This is stuff, A, that he would never do, and that B, he can't really understand why anyone would do it,
yeah.
much less this precious body, right, for him. Why would I put this body in danger? And
this is what you write. You write, what you want from Chris is what Walter wanted from Miriam, for him to love and miss me even as I cast myself away from him onto the world.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, I'm confident I'm coming back. He's much less,
yeah.
right, confident that that's the case. And I tend to assume that everybody is like me and will want to go off to these places. And turns out, you know, not to be the case. And so what Chris and I think the accommodation that we've kind of come to is that he doesn't actually have to understand why I need to do these things. But he has to believe that I need to do these things, and I will moderate myself as much as I possibly can.
I'm really interested in the way your relationship with art and science, the intersection, that seems to be in some ways a theme in your work and the way you think. And you write in the book that even though you live surrounded by scientists and that you believe if the universe is to be knowable, that we're going to be able to figure this out through science. But you also say, then on the other hand, you're also a poet and you're surrounded by poets and have been surrounded by poets, and that you understand the universe to be bigger than I am, as you put it. And you write this, for me, poetry lives in the space dividing the known and the unknown. And sometimes briefly, it opens a little gap in the thin membrane between. Would you talk a little bit about this? Because in some ways, it's so interesting. It's like the, for Walter and I think for Miriam, there was art and science, right? And it seems like this is kind of baked into you, that interest in science as being able to explain the world, but then that part that you don't maybe necessarily want to be explained because there's something ineffable about the art of it or the mystery of it in some way. Does that make sense?
It doesn't. I think maybe you've interviewed Karen Armstrong before,
sure. Yeah. So,
who's this really amazing theologian, and maybe it was even your interview with her that I was listening to when she talked about the difference. She was a nun, and then she became a scholar and historian of religions, and she talks about how she evolved her belief that no single religion, because they're all human invented, can adequately and wholly express the divine. And I agree with her on that. I'm a great respecter of every human effort to come cheek by jowl with the numinous, with the larger than the self. And I think that religions allow us to do that. I think I'm a poet because of the King James Bible, which is the Bible that I grew up with and that feels as if it's knit into the fabric of my being, that language. But as I grew older, I understood that paintings can do the same thing. And then as I began to understand more about physics, especially, but other sciences as well, I realized that they too, and especially if they're well communicated or well understood, well embodied within the self, that this is yet another way to get there. That if you are placing yourself on the boundary between what you already understand and what you don't understand, there are a lot of different ways to put yourself in that place. And anything that you can do to place yourself there will create the possibility of that opening happening. And so one of the things that I really try to teach my students, my PhD students in poetry, is don't only just read poems. Poems are great for this, but find those other things that are triggers for you and then let those into your poems and you will have more opportunities for that sensation.
There's a moment in the book I want to have you read. It gets at what you say is your relationship to gender, how it may even be more complicated than Miriam's or your mother's. And it's this chapter called What a Woman Wants in the book. Would you sort of set this up for us? Talk a little bit about this, because I think this is an interesting, just the reflection you have on gender is interesting here.
Obviously it started with my questions about what my grandmother wanted, right? And her difficulty in understanding even for herself what she might have wanted, which I think is an issue that my mother also had. She wanted so many things, right? And I think that one of the things that we begin to understand as we get older is that we don't get everything, right? We have to make choices. We don't get everything that we want And late in the writing of this book, when I really was trying to think about how do I fit into this? How am I, as the fourth generation of women in this book, chunking into this, led me to make this not specific to Miriam or my mother or to Mandy or even to myself, but to kick it upstairs a little bit into this question of what, which is a cultural question that keeps getting asked over and over again, and usually by men, what do women want? And that there's that expo that we have that I keep seeing in the advertised in the LA Tribune that it just makes me crazy, what a woman wants expo. And it's all about selling things, right, to women.
Yeah.
What a woman wants, every dress she ever wore, charm, athleticism, an ability to appear beautiful, whatever she looked like. Every city she lived in, every sea she sailed, a world that appeared open and uncomplicated as if it could be hers. Entitlement, lack of awareness, heedlessness, even more than I've got, the assumption of class privilege, in her case, unquestioned. The privileges of femaleness with no cost, the privileges of exception, the myth of one's own beauty, a full tank of gas, somewhere to go, no awareness of the messes we leave behind. I have poems, novels, essays written and published. Every morning I open the door on a page and walk into it. In the evening, I walk out again into my husband's arms and our life, often complicated by who we are, by what we want for ourselves and each other. To leave home behind as he did, to be missed as he was not. If I'd been like her, stuck in a house and desiring, who knows what I might have got up to. The luxury of travel for my own purposes, where I want to go, alone if I wish, anonymous, not in staterooms and suites with valets and deck games and staff to teach me how to dance, but on my own itinerary. Setting out, I take my own direction. Frequent flyer miles, enough to upgrade. My husband at home fretting or not, while I traipse up into the mountains of Java and the neighborhoods of Bogota and Medellin. I phone him with whatever device is to hand, usually one he's given me. Once in the Amazon, I call from a satellite payphone mounted on a pole in a clearing, miles from anywhere. As I hang up, the village chief gestures me into his house, where he sits me down and gives me a blowgun and bow and arrow for reasons I will never know. When he leaves me at the airport to begin my trip to Antarctica, which will involve crossing the Drake Passage in a small National Science Foundation research trip, on the way down through a gale, for the first time he breaks down. We will have only the phone in my dorm room, illicit late-night Skype calls. Where I am headed, there is no airstrip. If something happens to either of us, illness, injury, I can't get back. Though I haven't told him this, I know one scientist died down there, and they had to put him out on the ice until the boat returned a month later. I reassure him that nothing will go wrong, but how can I know? All along, I've believed his fussing had to do with gender, with his perception of my female vulnerability. But now I'm beginning to wonder if I'm projecting. My own relationship to gender, my embrace and rejection, my love of ambiguity, may be even more muddied and complicated than Miriam's, than my mother's. I believe in biology, in this regard, more than Chris does. I also believe in culture, in projection, in my own complicity, and in his. He has never thought of me as fragile, as any more vulnerable than he is, maybe less so. Only I can be headlong, much more than he, and more than a little preoccupied. We both know I could walk into or off of anything. The vulnerability that shakes him is his own. He believes he couldn't do without me. But when I tell my canniest friend our disagreements have nothing to do with gender, she laughs and points out the obvious. He has felt entitled to object to my going. And though I've resented this and worked myself around it, I haven't complained outright. I think of my grandmother occupying herself, subjecting herself again. My mother keeping house and three children during the long, cold winter of my father's sabbatical. Myself, while Chris built his remarkable career, before he always wanted me along. This could take centuries more to sort. When I return, he's remodeled a room, torn out and replanted the entire landscape, found a fitness regime for me to learn, bought some new device for me to master, changes I keep time by, through which he exerts himself from a distance. This may be simply who he is, a leader of men. I stop reminding him he's not my boss and tell him again, instead, that I am not his employee. Meanwhile, like the phone I carry, all this shows me I have been kept constantly in mind. In truth, every change is thoughtful, meant to make me happy, if not to make me stay put. It may take a few days, but unlike her, he forgives me. We settle back into something that is not quite the same as what I left. I want everything she had and everything I have, too. Permission. What my mother tried to give me, though she, like Miriam, never had it. I have never required permission. Chris has never let me go, but he no longer stands exactly in my way. Miriam should have been someone's child before she was a mother. She should at least have had that. And my mother, whose child should she have been?
Catherine Coles. Her new book is Look Both Ways, A Double Journey Along My Grandmother's Far-Flung Path. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Holly Vasek. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.